It's June 16th. A hopeful 23-year-old Minnesotan who came to Philadelphia on a teaching fellowship leaves his job at the local Starbucks and begins to walk towards his South Philadelphia home. The residential and safe, the walk should take about 15 minutes tops. On his iPod, he listens to a few of his favorite comedians. He buys a soda, he crosses the street towards Passyunk Avenue. It's 1:30 in the morning, and a summer breeze blows by, and he feels what it's like to be an adult in the city. 900 Ellsworth Street is where he's going, and he is making great time. And at 800 Ellsworth, those comedy routines still blaring, he's shot. Point blank. An ambush that leaves a single bullet in his neck. And his wallet is untouched. All that's missing is that iPod. Comedy routines now silent, with only his name written on the back. Bo Zabel of Austin, Minnesota, has just become the 139th victim of the year in a city quickly referring to itself as Killadelphia. Yo, son, it's your boy Young Chris with that new mixtape. Title that shit, Killadelphia. We got more bodies than we got days. Murder rate in Philly's crazy right now, son. If you ain't got a gun, stay in your house, homeboy. And if you ain't busting your gun, stay in your house, you bitch motherfuckers. I'm driving up Pennsylvania 29 towards Greaterford Prison. I've been commissioned by the Mural Arts Program of Philadelphia to conduct interviews with inmates involved with their painting program. These are guys that are paid 51 cents an hour to paint all the murals that you see throughout the metropolitan area. Murals that proclaim the strength, the struggle, the diversity, the brotherliness of the city of brotherly love. All painted by a group of guys serving life for murder. My work begins with a meeting.
Sean Lewis, I'm Jane Golden. I'm the artistic director of Mural Arts. I wanted to say sorry for keeping you waiting so long. It is crazy here today. Who am I kidding? It's crazy here every day. But the men that you asked about, that you're going to be working with, we got involved with them in 2001. Mural Arts, we found ourselves with a few commissions: social services, health, and prisons. The prison commissioner wrote me a letter. He asked if I would go in and teach an art class, which I said yes to. I don't know why. I was saying yes to everything at that point. I mean, I didn't know if anyone would even relate. We're talking about 20 lifers in there. But those men, they asked great questions. Some of them sent letters afterwards saying how much they enjoyed it. And a few even said that if a program like this had existed when they were kids, that maybe they wouldn't be in the trouble that they're in now. I felt a commitment after that. We teach at St. Gabe's. That's a boys' home in town. And you can't help but think that some of the boys in that school, they're going to end up in this prison. So we said, we have to make this work. If we can get some money, we have to try. And we started with a small mural in the prison auditorium. And it took these men forever to finish it. Finally, we said, why is this taking you so long? And one of the men responded. He said, well, we're afraid that if we finish, you'll never come back. And I just thought, we have to come back. If they're willing, we have to come back. Here's my card. And please, feel free to call if anything at all comes up.
Before I start the project, my mom throws this big barbecue. My entire family is there, and they all want to know what I'm going to be working on in the prison. And I tell them, I already know the play that I'm going to write. I'm going to write the biggest, baddest, white b-boy prison bonanza that the world's ever seen. And the world has not seen a lot of white b-boy prison bonanza, so I think I got this shit down. But I tell them, I'm going to make the inmates human. The audience is going to cry, they're going to stand up at the end. We'll all heal, I might become famous. And my entire family just smiles and nods. Nephews and nieces running all over the place. Aunts, uncles. Sean, get over here. Hey, get over here, I'm talking to you. Look, your mom showed us this. The business card from that lady up at the painting project. Yeah, everybody's really proud of you, man. Everybody is really proud, except me. I think you're a goddamn moron. You don't want to do this. Go up there and talk to a couple of criminals and a couple of inmates. Look, you want to be a writer? Fine. You and your girlfriend. You can move up to Nova Scotia. You can write some children's books. You can have a nice life. But not this. I work in law enforcement. I'll tell you right now. These guys are not going to tell you anything new. They're just going to lie and manipulate you, Sean. God. Now, when you first get to Graterford Prison, you walk down this long hallway. It's about 100 yards deep and 10 to 20 feet wide. And as you move along, doors open on either side of you, and it gets flooded with inmates. And the first thing that you realize is that there's no gates. There's no bars. There's nothing that separates you from them. You walk by shoulder to shoulder, face to face. And dotted along the hallway are 10, maybe 20 corrections officers, none of whom are armed. There's no guns. There's no tasers. There's not even a baton in this place. It's just you, a couple of hundred inmates, and no protection. As your escort says to you, Sean, you see how many of these guys we got on the floor, right? Well, if we had a gun on the floor, they would just overpower us, and then we'd have some real fucking problems. So, we keep the hardware upstairs. That way, if there's a disturbance, we can just fire down into the crowd. I know, you're looking at me like I'm fucking crazy. You know, my friends, they say the same thing all the time. They're like, Chuck, how can you even work in a place like that? But I tell them, you know, it's not like I'm some shopkeeper that's got to, like, treat everybody that comes in here the same way. I mean, I know who my customers are. Right, well, actually, Chuck, I don't understand. How did you get involved in corrections in the first place? Honestly, my parents dropped me off one day. Yeah, I know. I was like, look, Ma, I'll clean the fucking dishes, okay? But there was no jobs here. I grew up here. I graduated from school and I moved back home and there was nothing for me to do. You know, I was living in my parents' basement. And one day, my dad comes home. He puts me in the station wagon. He drives me down here. I fill out a couple of papers. And the next thing I know, I'm a CO. You meet the inmates. I'm supposed to perform a monologue from a prison play. Hey, guys, how are you doing? It's nice to meet you. My name's Sean. I'm just going to do a little performance for you. Great. No, you can sit wherever you want. Right. So, let's get started. Let me tell you about prison, which I'm realizing is a bad idea. It's like time, right? Like, time doesn't really exist here for me. You know, like, all the people that I know, they get old. They age. They die. But me, it feels like the same me. It feels like the same time, right? Like, time to get up. Time to go to the yard. Time to eat. Time to sleep. Time. Feels like I'm stuck in all this damn time. Our moderator gets up to get a conversation going. Let's give Sean a hand for his performance. That was very, that was good. Now, does anybody have any questions that they would like to ask? You don't have to censor yourselves here. You can ask anything that you like. Come on, don't be shy. Maybe let's start with you in the back. I'm Bobby. Start us off nice. Fuck no. That's really pleasant. Great. Somebody else, maybe Rico, you'd like to second what Bobby had to say? That's funny. That's very funny. Someone without a curse word. Oh, great. In the back, my man. Oh, yeah. That last speech that you did about time, man, that really hits home. Like, it reminds me when people come visit, you know, like, I knew this girl back in Pittsburgh when I first came into the prison, and she had just had a kid back then, and that kid just graduated from high school this year. You know, like, I see that man, and I'm just like, what the fuck, you know, like, I don't really feel any older, you know, but I am. I really am. It just, it gets me, you know, like right here. Even that repetition you were doing, I mean, that was good. Like how you were You were doing that, like, time to get up, time to go to the yard, time to eat. I mean, that was good how you were doing that. Like, there's some mornings, right, that, like, I'll wake up in here, and I'll throw water on my face. And then I'll realize that I do that at the same time every single day. Like, I get up at the same time. I eat at the same time. I go outside at the same time every single day. Like, is that my life, man? No. I'm serious. Dude, is that my life?
We play an icebreaker game called Me Too. It's really simple. Basically, you stand in a circle and you wait for your turn to come. And when it does, you jump into the middle and you say something that you like, I like the beach. And if anybody else likes the beach, they jump in the middle and they say, me too. Admittedly, it's a little ridiculous to do with 15 convicted murderers, but you have to do something. And it's also really beautiful. One of the inmates is shuffling side to side. He's saying, oh man, I don't even know if I know how to do this right. But shit, man, like, whatever, fine. I like freedom. And you hear everybody stop what they're doing in that room, turn around at once, and shout, me too! We're about to leave for the day after this. We're feeling good. We're patting ourselves on the back. And one of the inmates gets up, and he starts to speak.
Yo, can I ask you a question?
Yeah, of course. Anybody can ask anything that they like.
Uh-huh, yeah. That's cool. You said you're gonna come in here and you're gonna, like, write a play and shit?
Yes, that's correct. We're gonna do interviews and then make a play out of it.
Uh-huh. Well, like, how deep is that play gonna be?
I'm sorry, I'm not sure that I understand what you're asking.
Well, fuck, you said you're gonna come in here, interview us, and then write a play about it. I'm asking you how deep the play you write is gonna be.
Oh, right, well, we're not gonna write about anybody's crimes. I mean, if anybody's worried about that, we're not allowed to. We're really just here to listen. I'm here to help.
Oh, you're here to help? Well, we're glad that you finally showed up, man. Where the fuck you been? You still didn't answer my question. Because, see, this entire place is a suppression camp. And I'm not even talking about the prison. I'm talking about the entire world. We got two worlds outside these prison walls. One that people like you live in, and one that people like me live in. And see, we don't notice each other. Till them worlds, they crisscross, they collide, and some bad shit goes down. See, that's when we get some real nice boys like you in here trying to help. I'm wondering if you're gonna write about that. Them two worlds and when they collide. Cause that's some deep shit, man. That's some real deep shit.
Day two. I drive back. No escort or moderator with me. But on my stereo, I listen to that same CD.
I'ma show you how the North gets ignorant. Fuck who's innocent, the bullets I'm sending it. It's cold outside, better tell them dress warm. North Philly, get them bulletproof vests on. I'm coming for the mothers and they caskets. I'm killing all those preachers for they baskets. I'm straight up Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. Talk that shit, yo, I'm gonna slay ya.
I can't. After one day inside, I can't even listen to that. Instead, I scan across the dial and look for a talk radio station. I decide that it might be good to hear what the rest of the world has to say.
Caller, what are you asking me? You want me to care about these people that you are talking about? These people that you are talking about, don't get them mistaken. No, these people that you are talking about are criminals. They've committed a crime. Look, you know as well as I do, if you go out there and you commit the worst murder in the world, people, they just say, oh, let's forgive him. He said that he's sorry. Let's give him a little contrition. That's wrong. These tough sentencing laws, these were instituted for a reason. The American people, including liberals, demanded them. Don't you remember the 90s? I mean, the crack cocaine epidemic? the crack babies, the out-of-control murder rates, liberal judges that handed out a slap on the wrist to hardened criminals. Finally, the American people demanded a change, and those crime rates have been dropping ever since. So don't call in and tell me what I need to think about these people. What you need to do is you need to forget about them, put them away, lock them in a cage, and let them think about what they did.
I can't listen to that either. I pull into Grateford Prison, park my car, go inside, sign my name on a ledger, and they put an ID bracelet on my wrist, just in case I get separated from my group. I take off my belt, I walk through the metal detector, and that's when I see the front gates just slide open. It's time to hear it from the source.
Yo. Yo, man. Come here. You Sean, right? Yeah, man. It's good to see you again. I'm surprised. I didn't expect you to be around here again, man. I heard you had some questions, though, to ask about how we paint all the murals. Well, check this out, man. Back in the day, we used to do every single one of these murals paint by number like they were a big coloring book. You believe that shit? Yeah, man. It was good, though. They had this dude, Cesar, from the outside. He'd take a photograph, you know, of whatever he wanted us to paint. And then he would turn that into a transparency, like you put on an overhead projector at school, and then he put numbers in it. So we knew what colors to paint where. And those pictures, they were fucking amazing, man. They were amazing. You've seen them. Yeah. But that way of working, it changed. You should know that. I mean, Mural Arts is they're a great organization, but they've grown so big in the past few years that people like me, we aren't allowed to work here anymore. We don't have the skills, you know? But there's one out there back in the day you should know that my dad saw. Oh, man. He cried when he saw it. Yeah, like that moved me, you know? Like I was proud of that. My mom, before she passed away, she worked on a little bush on the murals we were doing at St. Anne's Church. Like, I'm gonna bring my nephew and niece to see that if I ever get out of here, you know? But, like I said, it's different now. I don't even work here. You know, I volunteer in my free time. My day job, I pick up trash, and I got a little journal that I write in terms of getting my expression out. Not the same, but it is what it is.
That idea of transparency stays with me. Okay, you take a photo, and every shade gets illuminated, highlighted, dissected. What was once just a number is now colored in and made three-dimensional. It's made completely whole. They're painting murals of the world, and I feel like I'm painting a mural of them. 16, 17, 18, 22, 18, 15, 17. Paint by numbers must be stuck in my head, but see, those are the ages of the first seven men I interviewed when they received their life sentence. 15. Imagine that. Imagine doing something so horrible when you were just a boy that a judge looked at you and decided that you were too dangerous to ever leave. 16, 17, 18, 22, 15. But still, one number stays with me. 139. Lana Zamora, the mother of the boy with the iPod, Bo Zabel. She returns to Philadelphia to retrace the footsteps of her son on the night that he was killed. And with relatives, she walks from the South Street Starbucks, past C&D Appliances on Passyunk, all the way to Ellsworth Street. And there they stand, in a half circle, arms folded mostly in prayer. This is where a robbery went awry, under a tree, just 20 steps away from the row house where this boy lived for the past 6 weeks. And it gets to me. It does. He moved to Philadelphia from Minnesota to teach. I moved here from Iowa to do the same. He lived on Ellsworth Street. I lived right around the corner. And his path home from work each night is the exact same one that I would take. And I watch them as they pack up things that they helped move here only a few weeks ago, put them into a white SUV, and just drive off. And one of Bo's friends, he talks to the local reporters, and he says all of the things that we've gotten used to. He says Bo was a sweet guy, that he had a bright future, that anybody would be lucky to have him as a friend. But there's one thing he says that gets to me. He says to be without him is like missing the ability to laugh. It's like suddenly missing the ability to cry. I asked one of the inmates what it would be like if they got rid of mural arts, the paints, the brushes, everything. He just shrugged.
I don't know, man. I guess, like, I would just write.
Okay, I understand that, but what would you do if they took that away as well?
What are you saying? Like, if they got rid of my expression? That'd be like taking away my life, man. That's a weird question. Like, I don't even want to answer that. That's such a weird question. I hope somebody comes along and lets you know that that's a weird fucking question, man.
That night, I sit down at my computer. I go to YouTube and I type in all of the words that are swimming around in my head. I type in murder, murals, crime, Philadelphia. I end up watching Mayor Nutter's inauguration speech. This is the new mayor of Philadelphia. I must play this back 8 or 9 times in a row.
People and citizens, it's hope that lets me believe that every one of us can make today better than yesterday. I believe it is every citizen's constitutional right not to be shot. We won't suspend civil liberties here, but we have to change the mindset of the people in this city. Now please bow your heads for a moment. Let's have a moment of silence for all those murdered in the course of the past year.
I scroll through the comment section. There's 154 messages. And not your typical YouTube bullshit, cursing, insulting, hating messages. These are personal. These are pained. Oh, I remember that. I am a fan of the HBO series The Wire, and I remember the promos for last season. They all said, crime is up, drug dealers are running rampant, and a mayoral election is of the utmost importance to the citizens of Baltimore. Then it typed across the screen the words, a new day, ... before it continued, is not dawning. I immediately thought of Philadelphia. A new day was Mayor Nutter's campaign speech. It's what he said the entire campaign. It is what the newspapers headlined the day that he won. I remember because I bought the papers. I was excited. I felt a lot of hope. But the murder and the mayhem. You start to wonder if maybe you were wrong. Maybe a new day is not dawning. I mean, listen. I doubt that criminals care who the new mayor or the new police commissioner are, right? They are criminals. They commit crimes. There is nothing rational about their behavior. I think that Nutter brings hope. I voted for him. But I don't think anymore that he can change a cycle of violence that has gone on in this city for as long that I've lived here. I mean, I'm hoping for a new day, trust me. But right now, I'm just hoping to make it alive to a new day. There's a few things I didn't know when I first went into a prison. I mean, the first time that I saw a prison was a movie. Bad Boys. And I'm not talking about the shitty Bad Boys with Martin Lawrence and Will Smith. I am talking about 1984. WPIX, Channel 11 in New York, would do this Sunday matinee starring Sean Penn in Bad Boys. There's this amazing face-off between Sean Penn and the Latino gang leader of the prison. Basically, Sean Penn has killed the gang leader's younger brother. The gang leader is completely out for revenge. And everything in this movie is about loyalty, honor, respect. A movie prison is so romantic. A real prison? Not so much. First, inmates look younger than you'd expect. I thought that they would all look aged, worn down, hardened, like the dudes you see on TV, unlike Oz. But everyone in this prison looks better than me, which, between us, kind of fucking pisses me off. As my escort says,
Sean, you're talking about a group of guys that are forced to eat right, exercise, and get the right amount of sleep at night. They look better than every motherfucker in this place.
Second, inmates don't have to be places if they don't want to be. I thought it'd be like a big high school. A bell would ring and they would move from room to room with armed guards. I go in one day and I say, wait a second, we can't start. Where's Rico? And one of the inmates speaks up and says,
oh, he didn't feel like coming to this shit today. he didn't feel like coming to it? Do I get that option? 3. It doesn't take that much to gain their trust. I go in one day and Oya, who up to this point has only insulted me for my shoes each day, sees that I have a group of Method Man lyrics written on my notebook. And next thing I know, we're doing the song together. M-E-T-H-O-D, man. M-E-T-H-O-D, man. Here I am. Here I am. Like I'm suddenly in the cool club at prison. Week 2. The inmates are working on an art project. They're trying to turn a cigar box into a collage. Zafir, one of the older inmates. He really wants to put gold glitter on his collage. I mean, like, he really wants to put gold glitter on this. And the other inmates are like kids at Christmas. They keep shaking the box, smelling it, going, "Oh, man, I know what that smells like. Please, please don't make me paint this. It smells too good." Zafir finds the gold glitter. It's a hot day in prison. There's no air conditioners, just fans. So when he goes to put the gold glitter on his box, the fans catch it and send it everywhere. So you have 15 convicted murderers covered head to toe in gold glitter. Oya asks me if I think it's strange watching them work on an art project. And I tell him no. And then I ask him if he thinks it's weird, though, that the project they're working on is trying to turn something confining, like a cigar box, into something beautiful. And he just looks at me. Oh, shit. Oh, shit. Oh, shit. Oh, shit. There you go, man. There is some of that deep shit. Sean, I was wondering if you wanted to look at some of my portraits that I paint. I don't have pictures of anybody that I grew up with, so I try to paint them from memory before I forget. And I'm good enough for some, too. Like, look at this one. This one's pretty good, right? That one's not so bad. I mean, other ones, like, this one's just horrible. Like, she looks awful. I just can't remember what she looks like anymore, so I can't really get it down there, you know? That's my own sister, you know? But anyway, this is what I think of while I'm in here, you know, getting out. People on the outside. I think about somebody like you coming in here, and maybe, I don't know, you'll see what I'm doing. How I'm trying to live, and you'll decide that I'm worthy enough to be out there with you, you know? I'm human enough. Otherwise, I just die in here with the dead, man. I don't want to die in here. And you asked me about rehabilitation, right? I don't think the other inmates in here would like me talking about it like this, but I think everything that they do to us in this prison is necessary. I do. I think it's all the right choice. Look, everything in prison is about choices. It's do you make good choices or do you make bad choices? And do you get the opportunity to? Because if you don't get that opportunity, how does anybody know the type of person that you are now? That last part, rehabilitation. That's how I end every interview. I ask, do you feel rehabilitated?
From what?
They say to me, every last one.
From what, Sean? If I was rehabilitated, that would mean I was once a bad guy, that I was guilty, man. I was never a bad guy.
I get so sad when I hear this. I go home completely depressed. I guess I thought naively that I would go up to them and I would say, do you feel rehabilitated? And they would say, yes, and I'm sorry. And I would bring that back to you and we wouldn't have to listen to any of this. We could just hold hands and sing songs and celebrate and pray or whatever we needed to do. But I get sad because I'm wrong. And because if nobody needs this, rehabilitation, growth, change, then I don't know what I'm doing here. I don't know how to help. And maybe it's ridiculous to think I can, but I am willing to be ridiculous for that. I don't know who's innocent. I don't know who's guilty. But I do know that the only way any of these men will leave this prison is through commutation. It's the process of having someone come in here and pardon their crime away. And there's a problem with that, because when you get here to Greatorford Prison, you only have 2 choices. One, you can admit what you did, hopefully grow and change and become a better person, a more productive person. But because you said you're guilty, you're never going to be let out of this place. Or you can say from what to everything and hold on desperately to your innocence as it stunts your emotions, as it stunts your own sense of responsibility,
all in the hopes that you'll be freed because of that. Because there's no other way to leave here. I mean, what would you do if those were your two choices? Me? I don't know that I'd want to be rehabilitated either.
Callers, whatever happened to personal responsibility? You do something, you own up, you account for it, and you pay. I'm going to tell you something right now because there are too many excuses. There are people out there, liberals, who will call everything that you have heard today poverty instead of crime. That is what freedom means to these people. It means no responsibility. It means no consequences for anything. It's just doing whatever feels good. It's saying that these people over here are allowed to commit crimes because they themselves have been victims. That's crazy. There are many poor people that never commit crimes. There are many rich people that do. Like, I mean, Harlem, New York, or the South Side of Chicago, or the East Side of Los Angeles. These are not the poorest communities in our country, people. The poorest communities in our country, according to the U.S. Census, are Shannon County, South Dakota, Starr, Texas, and Tunica, Mississippi. Now, have you ever heard of the people in these communities rioting to protest their living conditions? Have you ever heard of the people in these communities murdering? No, caller. No, you have not. The next day, I sit with the inmates as they work on those collages with the cigar boxes.
Yo, Sean, I'm telling you right now, people act up like they do all this violent shit that you're talking about as like another form of expression. What are you talking about, expression? I'm talking about their anger, yo. Like, motherfuckers is pissed off.
Yo, do you hear yourself, man? I mean, you're saying some retarded shit, so I hope that you hear yourself.
Yeah, man. I'm just saying that motherfuckers don't want to do crime. Like, crime is a young man's game. You ain't see old people do that shit because they know that if they do, they're going to end up in here with us. But you young, you see people making money, you see them getting power, and you figure, hell, life on the street, could it really be that much worse than fucking prison?
What are you saying? That you love prison? I don't know anybody in here that loves prison. If they do, then they're out of their fucking mind. Is that what you're saying to me?
Guys, calm down. Just relax, okay? Look, Rico, you got to admit that he's... Rico, sit down. You got to admit that he's got a point. I mean, we know guys in here that don't want to go home. I mean, they get released and they leave their shampoo and their shower shoes behind. Why? Because they know that they're coming back. And we have one guy in here. He was an old-timer. I'm not going to use names, but every year he'd come up for parole. And he'd walk around this prison, he'd just be like, man, when I get out, I'm going to do this and I'm going to do that. And then every time, he'd get a day away from release and he'd do something stupid in here so that he couldn't leave. He didn't want to go home. But we get guys in here every day on a 2-year sentence. They get released from that. And we'll see the same guy come back in here a few months later. Now he's on a 4-year sentence. He gets released from that. And we'll see that same guy come in here, who knows, maybe a year later. Now he's on a 10-year sentence. I mean, I noticed that. I'm a lifer. I don't get that opportunity. I just get to sit here and watch other people fuck up theirs.
2 years, 4 years, 10 years, prison sentences. 16, 17, 18 years of age, and June 16th, 1:30 a.m., 20 steps. Numbers inside and numbers outside, well, only one number outside, 139. Bo, a number that looks a lot like me. We have to be honest here. Since 2001, there have been 15,000 shootings in the city of Philadelphia. 80% of the victims have been black. 60% live in neighborhoods that I wouldn't even go to during daytime hours, unless I had to. One number is not enough. I need more. So I leave Greaterford, and I enter Philly.
Mary from Victims Advocacy told me that you wanted to talk to me about my son. Is that right? He's the only person I've ever seen dead. Did she tell you that? It's true. I mean, I've seen old people that were dead, but that makes sense. I mean, you go to a funeral, they look aged and worn out, but when you see somebody young, I saw my son with 7 shots in his back and bullet holes in his chest. And I'll tell you, he still looked so alive. He looked so vibrant. And to see him like that, it just, it reminds you how fragile life really is, you know? And I was mad. I was homicidal after my son. I wanted to go out there and I wanted to kill the man that did this to him. But I couldn't. I couldn't give him that power to take my life, take me away from my daughters. I've got 3 daughters. And one of them wrote a letter to the man that killed my boy, asking him why he killed her brother. And the man wrote back and he just blamed my son. And it was devastating. Just that no understanding had been reached. And we had friends that stopped talking to us completely. They'd see us on the sidewalk sometimes and they would cross the street. Like they thought that they could catch it or something. We had one friend, he just disappeared completely. He wrote me a letter a few years later saying that he had all the newspaper clippings, all of the articles, but he just had to leave town. And I counsel now. I go out to schools to tell my stories. You know, elementary schools and detention centers. And I always end the same way. You know, I look out at the audience and I'll say, how many of you kids here have lost a parent to murder? And a third of them will raise their hands. And then I'll say, okay. Well, how about the rest of you? How many of you at least know someone that has been killed? And you look out and it's got to be 90%. I mean, you see all these hands and you think, my God. I mean, we don't have enough for them. We don't have enough facilities. We do not have enough counselors. And we need facilities where these people live. If they want to talk to anyone, they have to get on a bus and travel just to explain how they're feeling. And we need counselors that have experience with homicide, not just grief. It's different. I mean, people, they go on and on about closure for victims, about having us move on. Well, you know what? You can't. Murder's not an addiction. There's no 12-step recovery for this. I mean, do you know what people said to me when my son died? They said, well, at least you know where he is now. Like it was better that he was off the streets. I mean, I guess they didn't know what to say, but I'd rather they'd said that. That they were sorry and that they did not know what to say. I leave Germantown, Victoria's home, and I drive west and then south. I end up circling the entire city before I come to an area that's referred to as the Badlands. This is 5 blocks in North Philly that accounts for 30 murders. I go west to Kensington, an area that's just as ravaged, and I get out of my car and I start to talk with the city itself. From a wing shack up north by Girard Avenue to the hipster movie theaters in Old City towards the south to the University of Pennsylvania's Trauma Center in the west. I go one by one by one.
Yo, ever hear about that boy Tartan George up in North Philly? I'll tell you about it, man. It happened right in my neighborhood. It happened right here. I saw it. So this kid Tartan is with his friend Jerome, and they come out of this like little corner store, and they get shot, like, drive by. And the paramedics show up, and they're trying to massage Tartan's heart, trying to get it to beat again. And his little brother is over on the side talking to the police. He's trying to give a description of who shot his brother. And their mom, she comes up out of nowhere, and she comes up to the younger brother and she grabs him and she starts to shake him and she says, like, don't you talk to the police. What do you think you're doing? We handle this our own way. Don't you say a fucking word. And I couldn't believe my ears. You know, this is where we live right now. And the mom of the other boy, Jerome, she shows up and she's the complete opposite. Like, she's walking around here and she's shouting at the top of her lungs. She's saying, look, I know who shot my son, and he's here. He's in the crowd, and I'm going to point him out. And that crowd, they just start to fucking berate her. They start saying, like, we're going to get you, bitch. If you run your mouth, we're going to get you. Like, this is where we live right now, man. Like, honestly, I hate everybody at this point. You know, like, fuck them. I don't want to hear any more of these parents up on TV crying when this is what they do when they're in the street. I don't want to see these memorials on my street corners. I don't want to hear the mayor and his empty promises. Or our do-nothing police commissioner, man, whose sorry ass, it should have been fired at least 50 murders ago.
I don't even know if this is what you're looking for, but I went down to the Ritz in Old City. So, you know,
It's the Ritz, so it's like a lot of people like me, you know, like young and white and hipster. So there's like a lot of tight jeans going on in the place, but whatever. So the movie starts and the camera pans down onto this newspaper heading and it says, Philadelphia, state of emergency. And like everybody in the audience just starts going like, yeah, yeah, that's us, man. That's us. Yeah, Philadelphia, that's awesome. Like all these white kids at the Ritz in Old City, like, yeah, that's us. I just thought like, man, we're really fucked up. Like, we really need some help. I'm Dr. John Wells, University of Pennsylvania Trauma Center. Now, please, people, quiet down. We've got visitors coming from all over the world right now, all right? From Norway to South America. They hear how busy our trauma unit gets, and they come to see how we deal with this level of danger. I spent a little bit of time at Abu Ghraib in Iraq, and I can tell you right now, what I've seen at the University of Pennsylvania rivals anything that I saw there. What is happening in Philadelphia is a war. And there's a big problem right now in urban centers around the country with what's called trauma recidivism. Basically, what this means is that victims of penetrating traumas, gunshot wounds and stabbings, we're seeing those same victims over and over and over again, just with more severe injuries. Perfect example. Last night, I had a guy come into the ward. It's the second time that I've seen him. First time, he had been shot in the hand. This time, the exit wound is in his upper thigh. It's a little bit more severe. Now, I expect I'm going to see him again, and he's going to be shot in the stomach or the chest or the head. It's incredibly frustrating. I mean, we know that we're patching people up to send them out there to get hurt all over again. I mean, it's a joke in the ward. And there's some days I look at the call sheet and I'll say, I know this guy because I took his kidney out. But see, that's the thing. You cannot be involved with this type of trauma for too long because eventually your luck is going to run out. Not that the headlines do. 21 shootings in 10 days since shopkeeper Bintu Samar was killed in the clothing store that she ran with her husband Amisi. A 16-year-old shooter has been identified. Yesterday, Hameen Span was killed in front of his house while setting up a picnic table to celebrate his daughter's birthday. The shooter rode up on a bicycle before firing 6 shots. Today, 37-year-old car wash employee Fasara Kuate was killed after handing his money over to 2 armed assailants. The shooters are described between 16 and 17 years of age, wearing black jeans and high school letterman's jackets. The papers talk about Bo too. They quote his father. And this man is stoic. He is amazingly understanding. Only a few simple words make their way onto the page. He says things like, I haven't really felt the anger, but I'm sure that I will because it's all part of the cycle. And I don't know the circumstances. I don't know why the other boy was trying to rob him, why he had a gun, and that it takes a lot of different people to populate this world. Bo just happened to be in the wrong place at the wrong time. And it reminds me of the first thing I heard when I went into the prisons. That there's a lot of different people who populate this world, John. And we don't notice them until they crisscross, until they collide. Week 3. It's my last day in prison. On my itinerary, I have an exit interview with the warden, a talk with the facilities manager, a discussion with one of the inmates, and a surprise for you and me both, plus Rico. Rico, who said, how deep are you gonna go with this shit? Has something else he'd like to add.
Yeah, I wanna read a poem. Is it cool if I, like, read a poem and shit? Shut up, man. All right, cool. Check this out. I came, I saw, and I lived a hard life. Drug dealing, crack dealing, smoking blunts with that good-ass weed, man. What a life that was. And when I think back on my former life, I regret living in those times. Baby boy, are you hearing me? I hope so, because otherwise, I'm going to see you in here with me, next door to me. And trust me, that's no way to be meeting your daddy for the first time. And though I never met you, I love you to death, and I would die for you. So don't be like me. I'm nobody. I'm just a number, man, with more time than I can count.
I've worked here for 19 years. I've been the warden for half that time. And I'll tell you right now, everybody that comes in here, it's the same thing. They all think that they're going to meet a couple of murderers, or they're going to meet a couple of rapists. Then they realize that they are going to meet a person who murdered somebody. A person who raped somebody. And we had a guy like you in here before, you know, doing interviews for a project of some kind. I mean, in case you thought that you were special. I remember he had this one story in his piece. Oh, man. This woman, she would talk about how she dropped her kids off at her husband's house on Christmas Eve. And then Christmas Day came around. And the husband doesn't bring them back, and she knows something's wrong. So she gets in her car, she drives right over to his house, but she can't bring herself to go inside. She calls the police instead, and the police, they get there, they go inside the house, and the husband kills the kids, and then himself. Now, this was in a play, and in the middle of the performance, one of the inmates stood up, and he said, "Why didn't you go inside?" And the actress, she didn't know what to do. She just turned out and said, "Look, I'm sorry, I'm playing a role, I don't really know, but we had invited everybody who were part of the process to come and watch the play with the inmates. So everyone who had been interviewed was there, including this woman whose story it was. And she stood up in front of all of these inmates and she said, I can answer that question. And you could hear a pin drop. We are talking 600 inmates, most of them crying, and she told them why. I walked her out to her car after that, and I said to her, is this the first time that you've been in a prison? And she said, yeah. And I said, well, what do you think? And she said, you know, I came here wanting to hate these people, but I can't. I just can't. That's the thing. I mean, murder. It's hard. I mean, these are real people. I mean, you get a guy in here on a burglary bid. I mean, we get them every day, right? That's a 2 to 4 year sentence. And after a little bit of time, that guy opens up and he tells you that he's guilty. He did it. He broke into cars day in, day out, like it was his job. Now, we get guys in here on a murder charge. A lot of them, it's the first serious charge on their record. And they're usually caught up in other things. You know, drugs, gangs, their neighborhood, their family. A lot of things. But at the same time, I hear myself, and you know what? I don't want to sit here and make excuses for them. Because I don't want to think what I'd want to happen to them if they were responsible for me losing somebody that I love.
Sean? Sean, you're Sean, right? I'm Saul. It's good to see you, man. It's good to see you again. I know we're not supposed to talk to you about our crimes, but I killed somebody that I loved, and I think it's important that somebody here talks to you about that. It was on a weekend, and I was on drugs, and I blacked out, and when I woke up, she was dead. I don't remember any of it. I mean, I just remember these pieces, these, like, really horrible pieces. And I can't do anything to make up for it, you know? I mean, it's horrible what I did. I do everything that I can in the prison. You know, I make these programs so that victims and inmates can meet. That way, the victims can see that we're not monsters. And they can ask us questions if they need to, if they want to. Most of the time, they just ask, why did you do that to my husband? Why did you do that to my son? Why did you do that to me? And there's never a good answer. I mean, you just sit there and you squirm like crazy and it's really adversarial. And it's important at the same time, you know, that they get the opportunity to confront us. I've tried reaching out to my victim's family to do the same thing, but they've ignored me. It's been 22 years, and at this point, I really just hope that I die soon. I mean, between you and me, that's it. I mean, my family had one of the best businesses in Philadelphia when I was growing up. I mean, we used to go away, like, skiing on vacations and holidays, you know, in the Bahamas. I mean, a lot of the guys in here, their life outside of prison isn't that different from being in here. But for me, this is really alien. I really just hope that it ends soon enough.
Wait, what are you asking me? Like, what it's like to work in a prison? I mean,
it's fucking scary, man. And it's really depressing, and it's fucking scary. Oh, I said that already, but I don't want you going away with the wrong idea. I mean, look, I'm just some ex-jock that's in here to run the facilities program. That means basically I'm supposed to put all of these guys on basketball teams. I'm supposed to, like, organize a softball league. But everybody that I work with is, like, a fucking killer. That's the thing, though. Like, you get to know them. Like, you get to talk to them and shit. You'd go to bat for some. Like, I'd go to bat for some. You know, like, if a parole hearing or something came up. I mean, others, no fucking way. But some, yeah, sure. I mean, just look at their ages and, like, when they came in, right? Like, who do we got here today? Like, shit, okay, you got Oye in the back over there. Like, he was 19 when they picked him up. And, I mean, Rico, he was 16. You got Bobby, that fucker was 15 years old. You got a guy like Job with his portraits. I mean, he had a full scholarship to Carnegie Mellon for trumpet when they picked him up. And, I mean, going back to Bobby, I mean, he's fought Muhammad Ali from this prison. Now, I know. People say crazy shit to me in here all the time. You know, I don't believe most of it. But one day he comes up to me, he's got a picture of himself in Sports Illustrated from the 70s, and he's boxing Muhammad Ali. That's the thing, man. We get more guys like this in here every single day. Like, the same young ages, the same fucked up backstories. And on the outside, I'm like anybody else. If I see a group of guys that look like this, man, I'm gonna cross the street. But in here, I'm the minority. My survival basically depends on me getting to know them.
Bobby. Bobby was this complete anomaly. He'd come to every single one of my workshop sessions, but say nothing. The last day in prison, Bobby comes right up to me.
Yeah, they call me Bobby Knockout. Or at least I call myself Bobby Knockout. But yeah, I fought Muhammad Ali. They told you that? It's true. Yeah, I fought Leon Spinks. I even knocked Tony Tubbs out once. But it was a different time, the prison. I mean, I came in here when I was 15, and I'm 53 now. You know, so I've been here for 38 years. And the prison in the 70s was a different place. I mean, the warden's the guy who actually taught me how to box, because he knew a 15-year-old coming into prison that people were going to do horrible shit to me. So he took me out of population, and he trained me to fight. And I got good. I got really, really, really good. And they started to send me out. Like, I fought in nationals from this prison. Because they saw what I was doing. And they thought that the young kids in the jail, they'd see me. And they'd realize that maybe they could succeed at something. They could be professional boxers or something. And some of them did. Like, Bernard Hopkins, world champion. I trained him in this prison. I trained Spadfora, the white boy out in Pittsburgh who's the top contender. I trained Moose. That was Bernard Hopkins' cousin. He was this little guy, and he'd fight the bigger dudes in prison, and he should give up, but he wouldn't. He would just swing back, you know, and you look at him, and you'd be like, he'll be all right when he gets out. He'll be fine. I mean, I trained one guy in here who went on to coach the U.S. Olympic team, and that guy was a fucking bum. Like, he was the worst boxer I'd ever seen in my entire life. And he's coaching the Olympic team. I mean, the thing is, we gave him some tools, you know, some skills he could use. It didn't matter about his talent. We gave him something that he owned. He can get a job anywhere with that. And then they took it all away. I'm telling you, man, it would be something if we could get anything like that boxing in here again.
Bo lost his life at 21 years of age, and Bobby basically lost his the day he walked in here at 15. And I know it's not the same. I know the circumstances are different. I know that Bo was an innocent bystander and Bobby a convicted felon. And I know that Bobby's still breathing, while at best Bo is somewhere in the ether. And people will say you can't compare them. You just can't, but of course you can, and you will. Trust me, I know I do. Every time that a 15-year-old kid kills another 15-year-old kid in my neighborhood, and I feel scared, and I feel defenseless, and I feel like I need answers, I compare them. And I ask, what made one kid a killer and another kid a victim? And how did it happen right where I live? It's like a fire. You either run towards it or you run away. And me, I usually run the fuck away. I'm no fool.
but that doesn't really put out the fire now, does it? So, what can you do? Well, if you're me, at this particular juncture, you get yourself a van, or in my case, a really fucking small Ford Focus, and you throw all your sets and your costumes, and if there's room, your director, all in that car, and you just drive. I start to perform this play before it's finished, little bits and pieces from my notebook. I pull up in town, do the piece, and we have a talk-back session after each. It usually lasts twice as long as the performance itself. Sean, I don't mean to be rude, but I just see a lot of whiteness on stage is all. Like, you're white, and this isn't really a white story, and if you just changed the face on the board to a black one, I would probably cry. It made me think a lot about my Uncle Terry. He gets out of jail next year and nobody in my family has talked to him. And we're all just like, wow, what the fuck are we going to do? I mean, Uncle Terry, right?
I thought it was interesting that you turned the lens back on the audience at the end of the play. I mean, we've been watching you deal with this problem for the past hour, Sean. I really think that we'd like to see you solve it.
And of course.
Are you gonna perform this for the inmates?
February 15th, Greater for Prison. The inmates that I interviewed walked past.
Yo, Sean.
Yo, I just want to let you know, man. Nobody in here has seen a copy of the play that you're going to perform tonight. I'm just saying, you better not say anything fucking embarrassing.
Yo, who's playing me in this?
Rico, I play everybody.
You? You think the ladies are going to like that?
And just like that, 300 inmates enter. The warden asks me if I want to go somewhere and warm up, and I say, yes. He takes me to a bathroom. There, I do my typical warm-up. I run in place. I throw water on my face. I feel like a little bit like I'm in the movie 8 Mile, Kim Basinger and Eminem. I definitely got the fucking vomit on my sweatshirt. I start to think, oh, shit. Oh, shit. Oh, shit. What the fuck am I doing here? This was a bad idea. Maybe I can tell them that I'm not ready, that I don't want to perform, but I can't do that. I start to realize that if I'm going to do this, I should probably omit the fucking glitter story. I doubt that glitter is really cute when you're in prison. I definitely shouldn't mention that I was scared of them, or that I think some of them are guilty. And no matter what, I shouldn't mention victims. I mean, in this type of situation, there's no reason to hold anyone's hand directly to the fire. I mean, someone else will come along and take care of it. Right? I end up talking about victims more than I have in any other performance. And I end with the story of Meg Guerrero, Bo Zabel's roommate. I recite it verbatim from a local newspaper. It says, nobody would have blamed Meg Guerrero if she had packed up her things and left Philadelphia after her roommate was killed just steps from their South Philly home. Surely she would retreat to her family and friends in her hometown of Bethlehem. Surely she would give up her dream of teaching in the Philadelphia school district. Everybody's just asking me what I'm still doing here, she says. And she tells them that the tragedy has steeled her determination to stay put, live out the dream that she shared with Zabel, teaching inner city kids. And they met on roommates.com. She moved into that row house on Ellsworth by chance in May. It was good, she says. We were going through it together, picking out our outfits, going to interviews, piecing together resumes. It was nice to know that I wasn't going through it alone. And she was visiting friends and family in Bethlehem when she received news of the killing. And she immediately got into her car and started to drive. It was so surreal. I got back there and I packed up his things. And his mom came down from Minnesota, but she could only take a few boxes back with her on the plane. So I packed up the rest and I gave it to Philadelphia AIDS Thrift. And then I went into his bedroom. And I called his mom, and I said, I want to keep his pens, and his pencils, and his pencil sharpeners, and everything that I can, and put them in my classroom. So at least a part of him is still there. See, on both sides, people don't want to be forgotten. In each inmate's cell, there's this window. It's about 3 feet tall, but it's only 6 inches in width. You can't see left to right out of it. There's no peripheral. All that you can see is distance. 1 mile, 3 years, 6 consecutive cases, a few states, a few federals, 1 life.
all in the distance. As Rico says to me,
"Yo, I'm just starting out here, man. What are you laughing at? It's not a joke. 20 years or 30 years? I'm 40 years old. We got dudes in here in their 70s. I mean, if you look at how much time I gotta serve and how long I'm probably gonna live, I'm not even halfway through."
On the radio, pundits are still going crazy.
"This is all just liberal coddling. Now, there are people out there who have more concern for killers than they have for children. They would rather save the killers."
There's so much information, so many numbers, so much data connected to real people that it all just gets confused. I think we all just want to put out the fire, which means that someone's going to have to pick up a bucket. In the city of Philadelphia, there are 3,000 murals. There are 7,000 inmates. There are 350 victims in a year, plus all their survivors and all their loved ones, and on and on and on, that make one city. One. These are our cities right now. Inside and out.
This has been a production of Working Group Theater, Iowa City, Iowa.